the north side of Chicago. It's the coolest bar in town. And if you go up there, you better just beware. You're gonna find a bunch of clowns. It's a mad, mad, crazy bar. The whole damn place is so bizarre. Full of all the vice and sin. Where do we even begin?
That is the commercial radio world premiere of the theme song to one of the most intriguing new podcasts in the world. It's not just Chicago. You're doing it in Chicago. My guests, Bruce Elliott and Liz Garibay, are two dear old friends of mine. The podcast is called As the Alehouse Turns, because Bruce is the proprietor of the Alehouse.
The mascot.
I know you. Yeah, the mascot is now your operative word there. Liz and I are both longtime aficionados of the Alehouse. It is arguably the most famous saloon or tavern in Chicago, and that is the setting for this now 6-7 episode podcast. Why a podcast, Bruce Elliott?
Well, that
why not?
I didn't know what one was, but Liz is the one that thought it would be a great idea. And then she said she'd take care of everything. Everything would go well. That was about a year and a half ago,
but it's happened.
I'm busy.
It's happened,
everybody.
Well, you're busy doing work for Bruce's books and the blog. You too. One of the hallmarks of this show, and I have listened to all. Are there six or seven?
Seven.
Now? There are seven now. They are each about an hour long. They are provocative. They're intelligent. There are very few podcasts in this country on any given show where you will hear William Butler Yeats, and then a few minutes later, a story about Street Jimmy or a story about Roger Ebert. Your world is a full world, Liz. This is why you've known Bruce for a very long time, and you have a weird, not contentious, but kind of pleasantly friendly.
It's kind of contentious.
Well, I mean, you know, the Alehouse is one of those places where I started drinking as a young lass.
You're a child of Old Town.
I am. I am born and raised in Old Town, and then, you know, I moved away here and there, and then when I came back to Chicago permanently, I started going there on a more frequent basis, and that's how Bruce and I started to really kind of, you know, chit-chat some more and connect. And we have a very interesting relationship. Like I said, it changes on a daily basis.
Yep.
It changes on the moment.
Well, it changes on the podcast. It changes from minute to minute.
That's, you know, and the crazy thing about the podcast is, like, this is who we are. This is us.
Yeah.
This is, whether the mic is on or not, this is the way we talk to each other, which is why I think it's kind of special, you know? So one minute he can go from being that endearing father figure, the next minute he can be, it's true, you can be very protective of me. Sometimes, it's rare, but sometimes. Or he can go on and, you know, be that annoying brother or that needy child. Most often it's the dirty uncle, but it just is a very unique relationship, which I truly treasure.
One of the interesting things about podcasts, and I one of the reasons that yours is so good, I think most podcasts are simply, and anybody can do a podcast. You need a microphone and you need some kind of platform on which people can hear the thing. They're mostly, it's kind of, you know, to steal a title from Norman Mailer, it's kind of advertisements for myself. And though, in a way, it is kind of promotional for the Alehouse, it is also kind of, in a quiet way, promotional for the drinking tours you do, historyontap.com. It is so much more. It's topical. It's political.
Oh, yeah.
It's opinionated as hell. And that's, I think that's the joy of it for me.
We didn't start this, honestly, as any sort of advertisement. Like, that's not where it's rooted by any means.
No, of course not.
I you know, that's one of my biggest, I think, criticisms from many of my friends and family and such, is that I don't promote myself enough. But I wanted to do this just because it was something I really wanted to do with Bruce.
Yeah.
You know, plus blogs, I feel. He does his blog.
On one of the podcasts, there's a relatively contentious argument. Bruce has, with Geriatric Genius, is one of the most successful blogs that I know of in Chicago.
Yeah, it's right now we're breaking all records.
I'll bet you are, in part because of the suicide of your friend, Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that's the reason, yeah.
And your disdain for his girlfriend, so to speak.
Yes.
But it is also something that Roger Ebert discovered, and that helped spread the word.
Well, Roger actually is the one that it was his idea have a blog. I didn't know what one was either. And Roger got my daughter, said, fix it up. So he just presses a couple buttons. And then Roger kind of coached me and plugged me. So that's really what got me started.
Liz, I know you're going to down, and one of the episodes features an argument about whether blogs time has come. But this podcast to me seems like a great extension, like the audio version of Bruce's blog. Am I nuts?
No, 100%. But I also feel like one of the reasons I really wanted to do the podcast was because there is a certain kind of magic of being a regular at the Ale House. You know, I keep coming back for certain reasons. You know, you go there for certain reasons.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's this interesting little dynamic that happens when you go there often and have these conversations with everyone. And I feel like they're very valuable, and I feel like that's kind of what I do with History on Tap, is really trying to give you the insider look of what happens in a bar. And so that's kind of why I really wanted to do the podcast. His blog is great. His blog is fantastic. He has all these followers. My only thing is that I honestly believe that kind of blogs are a thing of the past, so you have to move into, you know, new mediums. I started my whole career, this career that I've carved out for myself, I started that out as a blog too, but you know, I kind of moved on and to greener pastures and did different things, and so I kind of just wanted to help the old fella here.
Well, you're audio visual. You're not really an intellectual, and I don't think you really appreciate really good writing. So that's part of your generation.
He tries to compare himself to Dickens and Oliver. You know,
and Chaucer.
He talks to Oliver Twist and Dickens all the time, and Chaucer. Yeah, and Shakespeare.
Well,
and
actually,
those are apples and oranges. You are a great writer, but you know, whatever.
Well, but also one of the things that the podcast does too, and again, the podcast is As the Ale House Turns, is it does capture, for me, a person who loves the notion and the ambiance of taverns, what it is like to be in a tavern. It is recorded in a tavern. Even the last one had a bunch of loud guys.
Yeah, really very loud.
Yeah, it got very, very loud, but that's also what happens. It recreates, I think, the kind of conversations, not just between you two, but that go on between good tavern folks.
Oh, yeah, I think, and we're going to bring in more and more of our regulars. We've got some great ones coming up.
Well, you've had a couple on already.
Yes, we have. Well, one of them made sure that just texted Liz and said, under no circumstances, mention her name.
Right.
So, I don't know.
Well, she's mentioned in
the... I might shout it out.
Yeah.
Well, moving on. Then we had Andy.
Andy Shaw did
Andy
almost
Shaw
an hour on there.
He's emeritus at the BGA, so he was great.
It was funny, you guys, you and Andy are trying to figure out who the greatest... You both agreed that Royko was probably the greatest newspaper reporter, columnist.
By our lifetime.
Yeah. And you brought up one of Mike's famous lines, the "Where is mine?" as the new motto for Chicago. It is
in
"Ubi
Latin.
Est mea."
Is it?
"Ubi Est mea." And as I'm listening to the show, I go, man, that's Mike Royko. The other thing, the first episode, basically a lot of it is involved in the fascinating history of the Ale House, your friendship with Roger Ebert, the fact that you are, and one of the great things about you, Bruce, is you're wonderfully self-effacing sometimes, where you call yourself a variety of things, including one I love, the emeritus chick magnet.
Well, I just had my 78th birthday, so
that's when it happened. You became the emeritus.
It happened earlier, as I approached 70.
Wait, really? You stopped being a chick magnet at 70? At 69, you're still.
No, I'd say probably late 60s.
I am spending the next half hour with Bruce Elliott and Liz Garibay. They will tell you how to get, because I'm a little technologically idiotic about this stuff too, but the podcast is called As the Ale House Turns. We're also going to talk about Bruce's latest book, the third in his ongoing autobiography. It is called California Jailbreak, We'll also tell you a little bit more about Liz's ongoing beer focus tours and her getting very, very, very close to opening the Beerzeum, or what is it called?
Brewzeum, Chicago Brewzeum.
I don't drink beer. See, this is
you're a whiskey guy. I know.
You guys are both beer guys, and we'll talk about Bruce and have him define what is a Polish martini after a short commercial break. Rock and Roll Ruth is in here too, and she is one of the associate producers of the show, and we will discuss what that means.
And she's also living proof that I still am a chick magnet.
You sure are, man. You sure are. There's nothing emeritus about this relationship at all.
I don't have to fight them off anymore.
I remember when you did.
Rock and Roll Ruth is
a
saint.
Or just fight them. I mean, that was the other one. Just fight them. I got to tell you, Chicago's hosting the ultimate month-long food festival this August. Visit ctfoodball.com to get your seat at the table. We'll be right back. Bruce, you're pleased your third book is out. You talk about it a little on one of the later podcasts, the California Jailbreak. Liz Garibay is your
go-to girl.
Yeah,
go-to girl.
That's a good phrase. Because of some legal problems in the wonderful world of New York publishing, I've had to self-publish my books.
I remember I wrote about, and I'm going to write about this one too, and the podcast that, you know, initially, you know, Anthony Bourdain hooked you up with, you know, his publishing house. And they were very, very enthusiastic. And then all of a sudden, the lawyers got
well at the last minute. I mean, it took. He wanted to shape my blog into a book.
Yeah.
And after a good year and a half, a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money went into just doing it. I had no idea how to do it, and they wanted 80,000 words. The last minute, the New York the lawyers at HarperCollins said it was the most libelous, defamatory book that ever crossed their and nixed it. And
which is saying something.
Which I don't understand. If Tony read your blogs, he must have known that this was going to happen.
See, that's why I feel I don't bear all the guilt.
Well, I remember also not. You had to. I mean, you started getting releases from people.
Oh, like, sure.
Legal.
No, the lawyers at HarperCollins. I probably said a lot of inappropriate things to him.
I think
that's safe to assume.
That's kind of hard to believe.
Yeah.
You did have, and you were planning to have, guests on your podcast. You have had two so far that I can recall, and I've listened to the entire seven episodes.
You're on that list, Rick, by the way.
I'm on the list?
Oh, absolutely.
What about Rock and Roll Ruth?
I would love...
As an associate producer, is she in an executive capacity here, unable to...
I have been battling to have Rock and Roll Ruth on, Bruce's girlfriend, but he's very protective.
Well, I
don't blame him.
I have a confession to make. I have enemies.
Yeah,
and
indeed.
I think enemies might be very tempted. I mean, they could call me, you know, anything they want. I'm used to there's nothing really that they could say that offends me. I'm oblivious. But, they'll go after my daughter, and I'm sure that they would do that. So I think that probably a low profile is best for her.
Okay.
Until she really gets a bulletproof vest and thicker skin and everything. So,
is there any preparation involved before the show but to sit down on either side of a microphone and start talking? Do you two ever, in these first seven episodes?
Once in a while we'll say, hey, we should talk about this, and then we always forget.
Well, it's true. What's happened is, I mean, we do, interestingly enough, spend a lot of time together.
Sure.
At the bar, outside the bar, wherever. It is a curious little relationship. And so we'll have this banter no matter what, and sometimes one of us will say, hey, that could be something fun to talk about. And so now I've started to write things down.
Have you?
And sort of take note of it. But really, the only preparation comes while our dear sweet Jordan, executive producer, is setting everything up for us. And we're getting our drinks and getting our seats. And we start talking about, hey, what are we going to talk about right now?
See, one of the things about the two of you, Liz Garibay and Bruce Elliott, is you're marvelous conversationalists. And if you need proof, I know this from a lifelong of conversations, but all you need to do is listen to the podcast. You would go from the royal wedding to Prince Charles's ears to The Crown to Abra Prentice Anderson to the jukebox at one of the great ones. It goes from, I think it's show number 5. It goes from how famous the jukebox is at the Yale House, justifiably so, to you, Bruce Elliott, playing softball and teaching Bog Skaggs how to play
golf. No, his wife. Oh, yeah, him, golf, how to play his golf. Wife, baseball.
You met his wife.
Carmella, yeah. The late Carmella, right?
Yeah, some of his stories are, you know, honestly, even though they did happen, they're a little bit unbelievable. Like him playing on a softball league with the Grateful Dead.
There was a whole league out there.
I mean, right. Who does that?
Out in Marin County?
Yeah.
Divine Nine.
Well, then also on that particular episode, there's an encounter with Wilt Chamberlain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bruce Elliott has had.
I was a well-known heckler. Yeah. When I used to live in...
Oh, well, I'll bet you were. Well,
in fact, it's just in this book. It goes into great detail. And I actually won a lawsuit when Butch von Bredekoff, at the time he was the coach of the New Orleans Jazz. And he ran up in the stands and started pummeling me. But Wilt was really frightening because I heckled him for years, never even turned around. And then I just kind of brought up some. I was reviewing his new book, Wilt. And all of a sudden, he stepped across the bench, lifted me up. I mean, just with his arm fully extended, held me against the hockey glass. And then he uttered a few profanities and suggested I stop, which I did.
I bet you did.
In fact, Carmella Skaggs and my stepson, Yuji, were sitting next to me, and they both ran. They weren't there at all to help me.
He's a button pusher.
He is also. It's not like Zelig or something, but he has had encounters. Your life, Bruce, has drawn you into so many different interesting circles of sort of a darker element. And the book, which I'm halfway through because I just got it yesterday. You know, there you are at the Black. You're meeting Black Panthers. You're running into Eugene McCarthy in the hallway.
There's campus, walking across the campus, University of California in '68. Yeah,
and then you are going to drive back to Chicago at one point with Eddie Belchowski, the one-armed heroin addict, a painter, and a friend of my mother's. Do you ever think, Liz? You must appreciate the kind of raucous. An interesting life that Mr. Elliott
had. I feel like that's, don't take this the wrong way, Bruce. I feel like that's why I'm attracted to him. He'll completely take that out of context.
I've heard those conversations. Oh, yeah.
You can probably tell right now there's sexual tension.
Yes, it's all over the brand new studios of WCN.
When I first met Bruce, obviously I was very much the bar itself, the environment, is what really appealed to me. I'm that's who I am. That's the environment that I like. And the minute I met Bruce, you know, it's sort of like I knew he was the one. Yeah, I know he was my guy.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I knew there was an instant connection. And it was because of these stories and his appreciation for history. And truly, it was really also about his appreciation and his ability to be a great storyteller, which is something I completely value because that's what I try to do in my work, too.
Yeah. Bruce, have you gotten better? I mean, I remember conversations with you over the last maybe 30, even 40 years. How has it changed putting conversations on the page as you have in the so far three volumes of your autobiography? You don't seem to hold anything back on the page, but there's a more sort of formal structure to it.
No, I do hold back.
Do you?
I have to hold back, yeah. And I don't get punched in the face nearly as much anymore either.
And Will Chamberlain's dead, I think.
Well, he didn't. He just, yeah, he was very.
But just to be lifted off the ground by Will Chamberlain is pretty intimidating.
I'm telling you, he just held me right up against like a little rag doll against the hockey glass. It was disturbing.
But so you check yourself a little more in your
When I write, I have, you know, especially after that incident with the HarperCollins lawyers.
Yeah.
You know, you have to. So, I think I probably hold myself back a little.
You don't seem to on the podcast. Liz, what's your impression?
Well, I have a big job in that podcast. I got to control the guy. You know,
is that how you see your role? I mean, you see yourself. Well, no, you're obviously driving the show, as they say in the business. You're driving the show.
We have our conversation, but you know, you gotta keep him in check. You gotta tell him when you kind of have to give him the signals when to stop talking about something that's inappropriate. You gotta, you know, sort of just make him go towards a different path.
She keeps coming up with disclaimers.
Yeah, he talks about stuff that I don't necessarily. Those are not my opinions. I don't want to get in trouble.
No, you do say that often. I remember one of the first episodes. There was it started as a recap of the week at the bar, and then went off into Walter Jacobson.
Oh,
how
God,
Walter
yeah.
Jacobson was called Skippy, and how the
players. Remember how Rucker used to write about the players throwing jockstraps at him in the locker room when he was a bat boy.
Yeah. And then about his pedophile brother, and then Larry. Street Jimmy, and how you really want, as a guest, Michael Shannon. That's who you'd love to have on, because Michael is Michael's a good guy, and he loves the Ale House, and he's an interesting person. And he's, for all his stardom, he remains a kind of tavern guy.
Well, Rock and Roll Ruth is the one that got that viral photo of him watching the Oscars, watching his picture, win best... a picture, and I said, take that picture. And he's sitting there with the jukebox on, subtitles.
And a drink. Yeah.
A few drinks.
Well, we're going to tell you after the news how to get a hold of As the Ale House Turns. Liz will know how to do that, because I don't know. You can. I suppose you could Google it and it'll show up. You know, Ben, let's give people a sample of what the podcast sounds like. Ben, who has not listened to all 7 hours as I have, has picked out a couple segments. Let's hear one.
It took a minute because I really do have a lot going on this year, which we'll actually talk about toward the end of the podcast. But no matter, the book is out.
Well, it's my best book.
Thus far.
Well, I get better each book. Each book is better than I mean, it's hard to believe that after they're all good, but I get better with each book.
Well, I just, you know, I'm looking forward to reading it and looking forward to admiring my hard work every time I pick it up and see it on the shelf. And every time someone goes to the bar and purchases it, I'm just going to pat myself on the back.
You should.
All right, good. But a lot of people made that happen, so we're excited that now you have the trilogy. And you said it's already selling, right?
Yeah.
People are buying it.
Yeah.
You can find it on Amazon. If you type in California Jailbreak or Bruce Cameron Elliott.
And it covers the years 1967 to 76 when I had to leave Chicago in a hurry. And I ended up out of a pure happen chance going to the University of California. And then... After I graduated from University of California, I moved from Berkeley to Marin County, I lived in a strange little town called Forest Hills, where all hell was breaking loose.
Well, as soon as I finish your second book,
the third one. Well, we're not going to hold our breath on that.
We're back. That was a sample of As the Ale House Turns, the Bruce Elliott, Liz Garibay collaboration on a podcast. How do people get that? All I did, I think, Liz, was... Google As the Ale House Turns, Garibay and Elliott, and it came up, and I was able to start listening to the whole.
Yeah, if you, it's available on SoundCloud and on iTunes, and if you have any sort of podcast subscription app on your phone, you can type it in, and it will download to your phone, and it will also give you a nice little notification whenever a new episode is up.
How many people are listening? Do you know, Bruce? If people come in the bar,
it's kind of a mystery because Liz is, you know,
everything's always my fault, Rick.
Well, certainly, I mean, we're not expecting me to. We're not.
You know, we don't have books out because of me. You don't have a blog because of me. You don't have all these, this podcast because of me. It's all my fault always.
Well, any technological shortcomings are your fault. They're certainly not mine.
We're not really sure because honestly. I love doing this just because it's fun, but
Fun to listen to too. It really is.
It's a good time. All the data and those are not really my priority, so I don't go digging for it. But you know what? After people have been asking about it, so I'm going to go take the time and I will find out how many people are listening to it. I know that on SoundCloud it actually will show you the number of plays, and I think we've got about 1,000 or so on SoundCloud.
That's not bad.
I don't know about iTunes. I haven't dug that up, but
It's only been out for a couple of weeks because
yeah
we. bunched a whole lot.
We recorded about five in a row first.
Right.
Before we released them all.
And now, do you want people to come watch you? I mean, that's a strange thing, but do you want people... Do you want an audience? Remember when we did, when I did a WBZ live broadcast from there? I thought it was very cool to have people around. Do you guys feel the same way?
Well, there's really not room. I mean, the bar is usually pretty packed over here.
Yeah, you're right. So, you're right.
I mean, if people want to come in and stare at us,
there's not
why not?
Yeah.
You should, and you can also buy the books in there, too.
Yeah, you can go to
Amazon.com
It was really important for me to do it in that environment.
The total Bruce Elliott experience, man. You get the podcast and the book.
Yeah, actually, now that you mentioned.
And that's why we battled. Like, you know, he thought I should be able to just figure out how to do this podcast in a heartbeat. I listen to podcasts. I certainly don't know how to produce them, which is why it was so imperative for me to find someone who did.
You found
Thank God I found Jordan, yes.
Well, we'd be dead without Jordan.
Yeah, you know, and we were able to figure out equipment and things, so we got the right mics to be able to have that ambient sound.
Where in the bar do you do this?
So if you walk in the bar and to the left, there is a booth.
Yes.
Up in the window.
Up in the window, and that's where we are.
That's great. That booth's going to be famous. There's going to be a plaque. I'm serious.
Well, it was famous for Gilda Radner before, so I'm happy to, you know, step into her shoes.
Are you two having fun doing this?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
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 Except when he, you know, tells me that I'm not doing my job or something.
Well, but you're not. I hold you to a high standard.
When Bruce was talking in one of the podcasts about the fact that he's rarely had a what one would call a conventional job in your life, and how he, in his old days...
Well, I never had a full-time job ever. I had a part-time cab job.
When he was a full-time, not emeritus, chick magnet. One of the great lines in the seven podcasts I've seen, and part of it is because of the delivery that you give, it was... There's nothing sexier than seeing a woman coming home from work.
And there isn't really. I mean, there is not.
I mean,
I can't hardly describe
your feeling.
The feeling.
And the emotions coursing through you when someone has come home from work with a pay. And in those days, with a real paycheck in their hands, I suppose.
That's very important.
Now, are you really going to teach one of the podcasts? There's some discussion of how difficult a game golf can be, and Liz was saying, "Well, I'll be able to. I'm a pretty athletic person. I'll be able to."
This is actually happening tomorrow.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, I've got a light week because of the holiday, and so I'm going to go to his house to fix all the crap he needs fixing, and then we're going to go out to Jackson Park and so, I don't know. He's going to give me a lesson.
There.
Yeah.
And what do you expect, Mr. Elliott?
Well, I've got her a wonderful set of short girl clubs.
Okay.
So the clubs are top-notch. And
that's half the battle.
Yeah, okay.
Equipment's important.
Yeah.
And we'll just see if she's coachable. I'm not expecting a great deal. I think that's probably wise on my part.
I think I'm going to go out there and rock it.
But you'll hear stories out there, too, as you did on the podcast, about Bruce playing Jackson Park with a variety of characters, and on the podcast with Barack Obama.
Yeah, Barack used to come out and play after he got done with his law class. He used to come out and play a few holes, because my golf game really suffered after I had a child, so I couldn't, you know, so I could just snatch a little golf after she got home from school. So he would jump over and play in with me, you know, so we never got a full rounded. But, yeah, for almost the entire autumn one time.
And on the podcast, one of your regrets, and I've rarely seen you voice regrets about anything.
Oh, I have some.
I know you do, but I've rarely heard you voice them. But it was not asking Barack Obama what he thought of Jesse.
Well, there was several prominent black politicians that were I used to play with out there knew, and plus there was just guys in the know. And when they found out I had been playing for the last couple months with, you know, little few pickup holes with Barack, they asked me, "What did he say about Jesse?" And I, oh my God, why didn't I ask?
Because
he might have told me, you know, at that time.
Yeah, I don't think he'd tell you now.
Oh.
What do you think? You two are real Chicagoans, and you now, Bruce, are living in Hyde Park. What do you think of the Obama Center, Liz Garibay and Bruce Elliott? What are you, have any thoughts about that? What that's going I don't want Tiger Woods building some world-class golf course down there. Combining South Shore and Jackson Park.
No, it's a horrible idea.
What about the center?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that part, I think it's a great idea. I'm just worried about the design. I mean, all the architectural renderings I've seen,
Yeah.
In fact, Andy Shaw's daughter's coming to town and
working there.
But I think it'll be, and of course, you know, there's always going to be neighborhood people that are going to be mad because they're going to think that it's going to gentrify. Well, it's going to gentrify the neighborhood, but that's the whole Hyde Park area is being gentrified. So that's inevitable. I just hope architecturally, and instead of making it worry about having play places and stuff, just make it a serious, pretty. It's beautiful, right next to Wooded Island.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's a gorgeous area, underutilized.
No question.
I go by there every day, and there's not that many people using it.
Yeah.
I'm excited about it.
Are you? You think it'll be good?
I think it's going to be a great addition to the area. I think it's a necessary addition to the area. And, you know, let's be honest. It's Brock, right?
What do you think it'll do? Business at the Cove, which is one of the great neighborhoods.
Hang on, let's not mention. Let's keep that on the down low because it's sort of one of those places
where they're going to find it. People are going to find it.
It's my favorite bar in Hyde Park.
It's one of the great bars in the city. You know why? Because it's a tavern.
Yeah.
Oh, these are definitely taverns still over there. Jimmy's.
In fact, whenever Bruce makes me go down to Hyde Park, journey down. I have to pack a lunch just for the bus ride. And then I meet him there.
What are your aspirations for the podcast? To continue having fun? I mean, it is very difficult. You're not going to go out and get sponsors, I don't think. You know, it's also to help spread the word of the Bruseum once that, and it maybe happen this fall. The beer
we
museum.
We're still working on a location, but we have an opportunity to open an exhibition at a major cultural institution here in the city
in the fall.
In the fall, yeah, in October. You're going to be seeing a lot more Bruseum things in the next, I would say, even the next couple of weeks.
Wow, that's great.
Pretty exciting. I think I keep saying it's a year of the Bruseum. We have so many things happening, and we're really trying to get the whole city excited about it. And we have this really great plan for that to happen, and that's why you're going to be seeing a lot of things. But yes, in the fall, we're going to have an exhibition open at a major museum, and then that will lead into this two-year initiative we're working on and then open our doors. So, of course, I would love for this to be a great platform for the Bruseum. But honestly, like I said, this is all about me and Bruce and our relationship and sort of just having a little fun with what we know how to do, which is talk and drink at a bar.
You two are two of my favorite people. Look for a story in the Tribune in the next couple of weeks about expanding on what we've talked about tonight as the Ale House turns. I'm fascinated with the podcast world. And this one is certainly in my top 10. There's some good ones out there, but most of them out there are just like people getting on saying, hey, like I'm Rick Kogan, and I think that it's like really hot out today, and I'm going to play a song. You two are two of the most creative and interesting and provocative people I know, and I adore you both. You too, Ruth. You too.
Feeling is mutual.
Thank you.
Anytime. Right. And Bruce was we used to have a wonderful show around the holiday time with featuring Bruce Elliott, Jeff McGill, the longtime bartender at the Billy Goat Tavern, and Colin Cordwell, the proprietor of the Red Lion Pub.
We were talking about
the meaning of taverns, and those were some important shows. So listen to the podcast. It is called As the Ale House Turns. You can find it on Spotify, on iTunes, Bruce's latest book, and I would recommend having done it, reading them in order. California Jailbreak is the third in his ongoing series of autobiographical works. What's the next one?
Fraud and Deception is when I arrived back in Chicago.
See, that's a rocket.
76.
Well, that's some rocket stuff.
He's already on there. Me to help him start the formatting for all that business.
Yeah, tomorrow.
Yes. Keep my mother and the Kogan family out of that one. Except you really liked my father.
Yes, I did. I liked your mom, too.
Yeah, I know. She was good people.
I caught her. She almost went over a cliff at Roger Ebert's place in Harvard.
She was going backwards like this.
And that
doesn't surprise me. but they were good people. They were good people, and they raised me right, and they raised me in Old Town just like Liz. We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back and carry on the show. Bruce, Liz, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome back. We are still, as I said before, thank God Aubrey Mumpower, the world's greatest engineer, is in here because they're still... The studios are beautiful. They offer amazing views of the city and also offering an amazing view of the city is my next guest. I have never... Tony Romano, have we ever met in person?
We've met several times at Litfest, usually through Liz Taylor.
Yeah, through Liz Taylor. Litfest is such a nightmare sometimes. Were you there this year?
No, I was. Happened to be in Italy this year. I was on the schedule, but I had to tell them... I couldn't make it.
Litfest is so chaotic. So you should have been there talking about your latest book, Where My Body Ends and the World Begins, a novel that is sort of takes off from the terrifying Our Lady of Angels fire. But Tony Romano is a very accomplished writer. You were born in Italy, weren't you, Tony?
Yeah, in Fieschio, right near Naples.
But came here at a very early age.
Yeah, my dad came here when he was 37 years old. He didn't know a word of English, and he established himself and then sent for me, my brother, and my mom.
You must, in many ways, I don't know if you think of those days, and you know, with us, certainly with all the immigration crises going on now, but you must think of yourself as being unbelievably lucky to have come here. And I mean by here, I mean especially Chicago, because your work is so infused with your memories of and feelings about Chicago. Is that true?
Yeah, I'm constantly wondering who I would be if we didn't come here. What would I be doing? I'd probably be some kind of farmer. And uncertainty is a perfect frame of mind for a writer.
Yeah. Now, you did not start out. I mean, what I'm always curious about, you have three books so far, two novels and one a kind of, you know, the second one is kind of a collection of short stories that has the feel of a novel. When did you start writing seriously? Because your first books were published around 2007.
Yeah, I was a student at Northeastern. I was going for my master's, and I needed to write a thesis. And then I just happened to be talking to someone who said, well, you can write a collection of short stories instead. And that didn't take long for me to change directions. So I had a teacher there, Tom Bracken, who was, he never gave you a lot of praise for your stories, but he took them seriously. And so I think since he took them seriously, I started to do the same.
Did you find writing easy? I mean, there are many. Writing is not, and I will tell, and you and I will both tell people out there that writing a novel is, or a short story, is not as easy as many people may think it is, because you have to look inside yourself. Did you find it easy, Tony Romano?
I don't know anyone who thinks it's easy, but I'm not one of those people. It's one of the toughest things, but it's so satisfying. It's just the total immersion. When you're in the middle of a novel, you just walk around and you're wondering what's going to happen next. And it's a satisfying way to live, because everything becomes fodder for the novel. But I would never call it easy, no.
Well, you know, maybe James Patterson thinks of it as easy. Maybe someone like James Patterson, who seems to turn out like 8 books a year with a bunch of collaborators, maybe he thinks it's very interesting. You had a career apart from writing, have you not? You were a teacher.
Yeah, I taught high school at William Fremd High School for 32 years, and now I'm at Harper College.
What are you teaching at Harper?
English. I'm teaching English. I have two main classes, a 60s class and a Beatles class. So it's a lot of fun.
How fun. You and I were roughly, I think you may be a little younger, but we both grew up in a city and at a time where life was relatively, there was some freedom involved, where your mom, you could say, I'm going out, Mom, and all your mother would say is be home before it gets dark, and would let you go across the street. That really informs your fiction, especially where my body ends and the world begins, because I have vivid memories of Our Lady of Angels Fire, and that sort of shell-shocked the city, don't you think?
Yeah, it was a war zone at the time, and yeah, you're right, shell-shocked for many, many years. And the book is set 9 years later.
Right.
And, people are still reeling, and it's about a particular family, and they're still trying to come to terms with the
well, especially the fire. Kid in the family, especially the kid in the family. You know, the young man Anthony, who was sort of, in a way, this is a, you know, what impressed me about this novel so much, Tony Romano, is it, you know, I began it and started and thought of it as a kind of coming of age story, but it's also kind of like a detective story, and it's a mystery story. And it's kind of a family, it's a family coming of age, too. Am I making too much of that, Tony?
No, not at all. When people ask me what it's about, I have a hard time being succinct, because it is about all those things. And it's about grief and survival and kindness. I mean, one of the characters, Marianne, she wants to help this Anthony, but, you know, what's the best way to help him? She's not sure, he's not sure.
Well, and there's also a cop who I'm not giving too much anything away. I don't want to do that. There is a cop who is suspicious that Anthony may have played a part in that horrible tragedy. That, if you remember, in December 1958, Lady of Angels School in Chicago, 92 kids died in that fire, and this cop has some feelings that Anthony may have been involved, doesn't he?
Yeah, and that fuels some of the mystery that you were talking about.
Yeah,
And that comes out right away, so you're not ruining any of that. Oh, I mean, he has the first line, the cop in the first line.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, how do you think? Do you think, in some ways, Tony Romano, that you might have been a born storyteller? Because you were certainly adept at it. You have three books under your belt now. I'm sure you're writing or working on another one, or certainly working on a short story. Do you think you're a natural? Is storytelling run in your family?
Well, my parents, as immigrants, they only wanted to provide, so they never told us any stories.
Yeah.
And I think that might be why I'm inclined to tell stories. When I was like 6 or 7, we had this, you're asking if I'm a natural storyteller.
If you think you are. I don't know if there is any such thing as a natural storyteller. Maybe yeah. Shakespeare. But do you think you are? Because it does seem to. I know it's hard to do, but you've got a real flow and a very distinctive voice. And I think that's something that has to be almost innate.
Yeah, I don't know about that either. But I do have one story I like to tell. When I was 6 or 7, we had this stove in our kitchen, and there was this button. It was almost like a pin, and you pressed it. I can still remember how the spring behind this pin. And you would press it, and nothing would happen. And you would press it again, and nothing would happen. And so I would create this story that when I pressed it, that the whole world outside had changed. And when I pressed it again,
wow,
the world went back to normal. So one day I kind of forgot where I was. I didn't know if I had changed the world. So I went outside, and it was this bright day with low clouds. And I happened to see this substance on the ground. It must have been flour. And I thought the sky was falling. The clouds were falling. So I thought I had created this. So I ran back inside, and I pressed the button, and I made the world normal again.
Wow. Well, at least you're a kid with a good imagination, Tony Romano. Hang on for me, Tony, through the news, and we'll continue on talking a little more specifically about Where My Body Ends and the World Begins and the precarious world of contemporary publishing. We'll be right back. Have some more time with Tony Romano, the author of three books so far: When the World Was Young, a novel; If You Eat, You Never Die, a gathering of stories that kind of has the feel of a novel; And the one that I have just finished, Where My Body Ends and the World Begins, which is it's a lot of things, Tony, as we were saying before. It is a lot of things. When you were first published in book form, how empowering was that for you as a writer? I know you'd done essays before, and some of your short stories had won prizes, but seeing your work between covers is something extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And it kind of just takes your breath away. Just to be able to present that to my parents,
yeah,
even though they didn't value books, was quite a thrill.
Well, and your parents...
The second book, If You Eat, You Never Die, is something my dad used to say all the time. So to be able to present that to him was a thrill.
How do you find... the first two books were published roughly a decade ago between books. How have you watched, Printers Row, Lit Fest aside, the publishing business has gotten kind of nutty in the last 10 years, has it not?
Yeah, it's pretty much with the collapse of the economy in 2008, where publishers aren't willing to take a chance on nurturing a writer.
Yeah.
Just looking for the blockbuster.
Did you feel lucky to find a publisher? I mean, Where My Body Ends and the World Begins... You know, your first two books were HarperCollins books, and this certainly should have been one, too. It didn't discourage you, did it? Because you're a writer, and writers want to be published, and any publisher will do, yes?
Yeah, what I liked about this is I'm a Chicago guy, and it's a Chicago story, and this is a Chicago publisher, Allium.
Yeah.
And she was one of the best editors I've ever worked with, Emily Victorson.
Yeah, I ran into her at some kind of Cliff Dwellers gathering literary gathering where she was just raving about you. And you have to, in this book business, become your kind of own merchandising and promotion outfit, don't you? You have a great website.
Well, thanks. Yeah, you do have to push it, and that's not my personality. I was always painfully shy as a kid, and I think that's one of the reasons I went into teaching to deal with that. And so I'm fine in front of a group, but I'm still on the shy side, and I'm not the best salesperson. So
well, I gotta tell
you, have to do.
Wait a minute, I gotta tell you if you go to Tony's website, TonyRomanoAuthor.com, you will see a 4-minute long video called On Writer's Block. Tony, I think you must have had a ball making that, did you not?
Yeah, I did, and it's my nephew at the end there. So he's
the nephew who you pay the money to for advice about how to get out of writer's block, and it has you in a tree, it has you on a scooter, it has you paying this cute little kid for some advice. You do like reading your own stuff, do you not?
Yeah, I do. I've enjoyed especially reading from this book for the last 6 months or so. And I was never a really good reader, so I've practiced a lot, and I worked at it.
What are you working on now?
I actually wrote a screenplay for the book.
Oh, that's...
My daughter's out in California, and so she read it, and she gave me a lot of good tips.
Is she in the movie business?
Yeah, she's working as a screenwriter. She's just starting out, and she's just close to making a breakthrough.
Wow, that's great. That's great. You have another child, too, do you not?
Yeah, three daughters altogether. Yeah.
What do the other two do? Are they in some sensible business rather than the movie business?
Nothing that makes a lot of money. One's in musical theater, and the other one writes for College of DuPage. So all in some kind of artistic endeavor.
Well, that's all your fault, Tony Romano. You know that, don't you? You know that.
Yeah,
are you gonna? You're not going to be appearing anywhere soon, are you? For Where My Body Ends and the World Begins.
No, nothing on the schedule.
That's too bad because
I had a busy 6 months. But
well, what I really recommend you folks doing is going to Tony's website. Part of it is a blog. He's got some essays and stories, but these videos. You know, you do reading part of the first chapter of When the World Was Young. There's a video and a read in that, and it's charming. It's Tony Romano, author.com. Tony, one day I want to meet you apart from LitFest, where I can't even... it's too chaotic there for me. Do you enjoy LitFest? I know you weren't there this year, but do you enjoy it?
Oh, yeah, I really do. I'm usually a moderator.
And yeah.
Now that this book came out, I was looking forward to being on the other side of the table. But this trip for Italy, it was only week we could get everybody together to go. So.
Well, that's crazy. If there's a choice between Italy and Printer's Row LitFest, I'd go for Italy. Tony, I can't wait to meet you one of these days face-to-face where you can sit around and talk about the joys and troubles of writing his latest book. I have already ordered the previous two after reading this one, Where My Body Ends and the World Begins. You are a strong, and your narrative drive is really something, and it's so Chicago. I don't know what more to say. Tony, you're a credit to this literary scene, and this literary scene is an active one.
Yeah, I appreciate the kind words, Rick.
No trouble. I can't wait to buy you a drink sometime.
I look forward to that.
Me too. Me too, Tony. Take care, and great success, and keep writing. That's all I can say. Okay?
Okay, great. Thank
all right.
You.
Take care. See ya. A nice guy. Very, very nice guy. We're going to have a terribly talented musician in here who hails from Orland Park. It's where he grew up. That's where he lives now. And the years between were wild and crazy and very creative. Michael McDermott will be in here, and you can hear, while we talk for 45 minutes, you will hear much of his music, so please stay tuned. Welcome back. I am pleased to be in here with Michael McDermott, a child of Orland Park, and who has had I've known a lot of music. I don't go out and hear music as much as I used to in the old days, but he has had as interesting a career, from what I have read and heard, as almost anybody. You remind me of some of the guys I used to know.
Yeah.
Who were children of the 60s, Michael. you've had some up and downs in
yes.
your career. One of the interesting things is you got hot very young.
Mm-hmm.
How?
Well, so I was on my way here, and the studio's amazing, and I was feeling a bit like that new Jurassic Park movie. I was wandering through the city because I was very kind of vampiric. I was like the dinosaur walking apocalyptic streets, boom. But this is beautiful, and what a
yeah, studio. The views
unbelievable.
The views
yeah.
are really amazing.
But I was thinking about it. So back in your guest Bruce, it's amazing. I didn't like kind of cross paths with him. I'm stunned that, and maybe I didn't. I just don't remember.
You might have, yeah.
But I got involved very early from Orland, though. I moved into the city very young, just out of high school, 88.
Where'd you start hanging out?
So it was like Earl of Old Town.
Oh my God, a half a block from the Ale House.
Yeah, and then Earl's Pub. Then it was and Orphans and. So it was a bunch of those things. Mike Jordan, Tom Dundee,
See, Mike's an interesting guy. I know he was a big influence in your life because
yeah.
Mike was a, and he, you know, I know he died in like the early 90s,
yep.
and so did Stevie. And Mike was a very influential guy who should be, I think,
yeah.
sort of named with.
Yes.
John Prine.
Yeah.
And, Steve
and I talked
Goodman.
To Prine about him too. And,
yeah.
and you know, he certainly remembered. But yeah, he was amazing. And when I first got signed, I tried to get Mike signed. Like that was my dream. And
yeah.
The guy that signed me, Brian Koppelman, who's now gone on, you know, he has that show Billions and
sure.
wrote all these movies. But so I played a bunch of Mike's stuff for Brian, and he said, "This is amazing. I can make a real cheap record." And I said, "Yeah, yeah, do it, do it." And then so I got him in touch with Mike, and he was living in Foley, Missouri. And so I said, "Mike, this guy's very interested. Send him stuff." And it's kind of similar to the Bruce story he was telling, I was listening to in the car earlier. But then Mike didn't, you know, he had a bit of a chip. And so Brian just wanted to hear more songs, and I said, "Send him more songs." And he's
yeah.
like, "You know, man, I just don't want to go through the thing." I was like, "What thing?" Just
one of the interesting things. I mean, you were young. I mean, what happened mm-hmm. to you? It seems to me it reminds me of something. I don't know if you even know this name. A guy named Bill Quaitman.
I don't.
Who was a big folk rock guy around the time John and Steve were doing that? He got plucked. An incredibly good-looking kid. He got plucked out of Chicago, got a big record deal,
yeah.
taken to L.A., and just got swallowed.
Yeah, swallowed.
Alive.
Yeah.
in a sense, that success, do you think, came too quickly for you?
I do. I remember this guy saying, Michael McDermott, it's never a question of if, it's a question of when.
Wow.
And
my, that can turn your head.
Yes,
I mean, that can...
Yeah. No, I was kind of washed up by the time I was like 23. I was.
Well, some of that was your own doing,
it was,
too.
My demise was very orchestrated.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to, you know, like, and meeting, and I'm not being unctuous here, but I wanted to meet you so badly because I feel like I was a man out of time, or a kid out of time even. Like, I was in Earl's reading Ginsberg, and I was, you know, like, people were like, who is this kid with the sunglasses on? I mean, it was ridiculous.
Sure.
But I was seeking something, you know, a time that I was definitely misplaced. So, but yeah, I feel that, and that was such
a... How old are you?
I'm 48.
Yeah. Yeah, see, if you were about, I'm just thinking, you know, if you were 12, 15 years older, then you were part of that.
Right.
That the previous scene, and you got in there where there was, the scene was in such flux.
It was, and there wasn't much, and I remember Chris Farrell, like, you know, sitting there telling me how to read Kerouac, you know, that there's a way to read. I didn't know that, you know, like, it was, and I was just a kid, and my friends were at, you know, at college parties, you know, and it was a different life I was living in.
Well, what kind of life, what did your parents do? What kind of life in Orland did you have?
My dad sold insurance, and, you know, the Woody Allen joke, there's, you know, the only thing worse than death is being caught in a room with an insurance salesman. That was not my father. But yeah, they did that, and my brother took over the business. My dad lived beyond his means, and so we were always kind of constantly in a state of losing everything in the house and all that.
Where'd you go to high school?
Carl Sandburg.
Did you leave?
Sorry?
Did you graduate?
I did.
With any notion of going to college?
I went to a day of Loyola, and then I just realized when I got the syllabus, I dropped out.
Yeah, that's like me. I went to a day of Circle Campus. You are out of time. When did you start? When did music get in your life?
It was like eighth grade or something like that. And
ow.
I saw the Stones, you know, and it was a weird role model to have Keith Richards, you know, and I took care of the drugs, the addiction, and the prison sentences, and I took care of all that except the success. It would have been a perfect ending. But
what was it, Michael McDermott? Was it a sense of now that you're older and can have some perspective on it, was it a sense of freedom that they embodied, or was it a sense of freedom and fun too?
No, I never thought it was supposed to be fun, and maybe I should have gotten that. Because that Brian Koppelman, in fact, he took me into, after my first or second record, he brought me in and he started playing me these Van Halen songs, and I was like, and he played another one, and I said, what's the point of all this? And he said, it doesn't all have to be so serious.
Wow, interesting.
You know, and I was like, you're right. You know, it can be fun. I think it was the outlaw nature of it, which I think is why I got into drugs, quite frankly.
Sure.
It's a whole counterculture. It's very secretive. There's a lot of handoffs, a lot of secret meetings.
Well, also when you're 19 and you've got your first album out, and you're traveling a little bit, the seductions of the road for a 19. You know, it's like, it's what I imagine life as, like an NBA star.
If
you don't have 80 people around taking care of you.
Right.
And I suppose it's very, very seductive.
It is. It's the only job you're encouraged to be out of your mind, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, even in ball players, they have to perform.
Sure.
So that was I was never much of a drinker. I never did drugs. So, like, but then shortly thereafter, when it's just available all the time and... You know, things start going south. It was a perfect storm of sorts. Yeah.
What about the career? As one's career, and you kind of just, I'm not going to say you were like a one-hit wonder, but you were like a one-album hotshot.
For sure, yeah. Absolutely, it's fair to say.
And then that vanishes, you can still perform and you can still play, but it's...
But I was crippled.
It's a weird limbo, isn't it?
It was. It was terrible. It was totally in between. And being still so young and not knowing, like, wait, now what? So that was terrible.
What kind of support did you get from your folks?
They were very supportive, and I didn't even realize...
Were they worried?
I think so. Certainly knew about the declining health and all that, and there were interventions. And then when I was facing 3 to 6 years in prison, you know, that was, it was a drug bust, but I had a lot. And it was serious.
Where were you?
I was at the House of Blues, actually. You know, which I thought was...
You were going in to see a friend, right?
I was, yeah. And I thought it was funny that a place built on cocaine would be that...
Right. That's the money to build that place came from cocaine.
So, yeah. So, anyway, so it was a long way down, for sure.
And, how far down?
Well, I was almost dead, really. And, I was yellow, and my wife's listening to me breathe because I would stop on occasion. And it was very, Nick Cage leaving Las Vegas kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a remarkable recovery, too, and we will talk about that. And yeah, all the while, though, you kept producing music.
Which is the most amazing
thing.
Which
must have, in a sense... It is amazing, but it also must have, in a sense, been a kind of salvation for the music, or was it more like a life raft?
I was just going to say that. Yeah, it was. It was a life preserver, really. I just was hanging on by a thread. And but you know what makes the only you were saying to Bruce, like he had regrets too, and I thought, you know, regrets are a funny thing, and it's, you know, there's some that would say there's nothing good or bad in life. It's just, you know, how you define those things. And the only thing I would feel I have any pangs of regret are that I wasn't as clear to work. My work suffered. Yeah. And it really didn't. That's all that ever really mattered. And now it feels like I'm making up for lost time and I'm kind of working like a fiend.
But also, you know, I this is a very interesting conversation. And your music is what has informed me about all this. That you know, it's more common in jazz that, you know, these people can, like Billie Holiday can be beaten up and beaten up and beaten up, and then it shows in her music, but she doesn't write her music. That's the interesting and different thing. I'm going to spend the rest of this show talking to Michael McDermott about his music and his life and his latest CD and his wife and his kids.
Well, I have some questions for you, too, so I don't know if we're going to get to all that. I have some questions for you, too, so I don't know if we're going to get to it. You said it was my show.
Welcome back. I have another half hour with my new friend, Michael McDermott.
Half hour.
You can learn a lot about him beside the stuff we're talking about, like going to jail and doing drugs and snapping out of that, by going to michael-mcdermott.com. It's a great website. It shows you all these upcoming engagements and a very, very frank sort of little bio you've written called Out From Under. And that's what he has come out from. He's out from under some nasty times.
Yes.
That would have done in. I mean, I've known people... We've both known people in this business who don't come out.
Yeah. And that's, you know, when I mentioned, you know, not being working with a clear eye, the fact that I was so flippant and so whimsical with life is the most embarrassing thing, because now I'm very grateful to be alive, and I love it here. And even given this very disquieting time, it's I would like to stick around.
Yeah, as weird as is the time we live in.
Right.
Your wife, Heather, certainly helped you out of that.
She did.
And your daughter, Rain.
Yes.
There's nothing like having a kid making sense of life.
Yeah. And there's nothing like a kid looking at you like you had three heads, you know, to sober you up a bit, you know. But yeah, it was, I needed, in some way, I think I needed permission to stop. I felt like I was a little bit out of control, and I was just kind of, and she finally couldn't take it. And I think I was waiting to do that.
That's
and pushed
really
her
good.
To.
Now, how long have you been straight and sober?
4 years, over 4 years. Yeah.
Is it hard?
Tough question.
A tough thing to do.
Yeah, it was tougher, you know, at the earliest days.
Sure.
Were very, very hard. But now I don't think about it that much, you know.
Other things are giving you sensory feedback.
So it's just about
feedback.
Because everybody works programs, and if you work an unconscious program, which is what I was working, I was just kind of very numb to everything. But now everything sticks, and so now I do other things to.
Let's hear you. You get to play disc jockey.
Okay.
What are we going to hear?
So this is the title track. I always wanted to say that on the radio. From the new record, Out From Under. Michael McDermott here on GN.
Thank you. curtains of the day. I'm tired of feeling helpless. You know we can't go on this way. Oh, wake me from this cruel and senseless slumber.
Oh, thank you.
I really do.
Thank you.
Where do you record?
I do that at home. I did it in Willow Springs, actually, where we were living at the time, yeah.
Now, your wife plays with you.
She does, yeah.
And she does her own stuff, too.
She does.
How did you two, you met, she joined your band.
She did.
And
she
basically,
was,
right?
Yeah, I was looking for a fiddle player and went to the Underground Wonder Bar in Walton and walked in. And she was,
oh, so the old Underground Wonder Bar.
I walked in, Rick, and she and I hear this song that I know, that I, and it was a Mike Jordan song, and I was enraged, though. I was like, who would dare play Mike stuff? Up there, think, you know, and then so afterwards I said, I don't know whether to kill you or marry you, because how do you do a Mike Jordan song? She's like, and she didn't even know the title of it. She just got
like,
it.
Who are you?
I know. Who are you? So,
her name
anyway,
is Heather Lynn Horton, and one of her CDs is Don't Mess with Mrs. Murphy. You've been married since 2009?
Yeah. Got married in Italy on tour, in the middle of like a 16-day tour.
You have a very active tour schedule.
I do, yeah.
Do you like that still? Does it? It doesn't bring back any ghosts for you.
No, it doesn't.
And probably the people who approach you now are not the same goofballs who approach the 19-year-old Mike McDermott.
Well, most of the time, like in Italy, too, people would always be like, Michael, why do you drink so much? You know, like so I think they're, you know, certainly that country's happy that I'm not drinking anymore. But yeah, so no, it's great. But I'm much more workmanlike now. I do my show. Go back to the hotel. Well,
how has your songwriting been enriched by sobriety?
I think it's just a clear...
Can you sense it, or...
I try not to think about it, you know?
Yeah,
and
course.
I don't know
yeah,
how you,
sure.
you work,
I'm,
and that's what I wanted to ask you, too. Like, you know, certainly there's a... It's a whole different climate as a writer now, and you must feel that, you know? And there's a different way you approach language, I think, now, and I don't know. I was going
to
ask you...
I try not to. I mean, I try to, you know, it's you know, the venue is a newspaper, and I am not... Instead of fighting the urge to be
anything
celebrity,
but
I don't do clickbait.
Right,
you know, I just
right.
I don't know what it is. I don't know. I know that you know.
But see, authenticity though work. I mean, that's what I think ultimately people respond to, and you know, and that's why I think you've managed to have such a great career.
That means a lot to me.
It's
tough to. You know, nobody has ever been able to think, you haven't, no songwriter I know, the Beatles got lucky, but no songwriter I know can say, I'm going to write a song that 20 million people buy. You can't do it because it's not going to be genuine.
No, it's going to be awful. Yeah, so I try not to think about writing. I just write.
Yeah.
You know, and then the story, like, you know, like Michelangelo said, he just released what was in the stone, you know, and that's kind of what we do as writers, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
correct.
Yeah. What's your daughter think of what her parents do?
She's very unimpressed.
She's nine now?
Yeah, no, seven.
Seven.
Gotta be
seven.
Yeah, she's very, she's very, you know, she's kind of over it already. You know, people
don't play so loud. Yeah,
yeah, oh, yeah.
Don't play so loud. But you're a rock. I mean, you're really a musical family. Does she go on the road with you, Rain?
Not often, but she does because now the school. But she's been, you know, overseas in Europe, and it's a grind. You know, it's having a small child.
The music business confounds me these days.
Yes,
because of the whole notion of creating a CD. When one creates a CD, and tell me I'm wrong, it is created with a certain narrative that one song is. This is cut one, and this is cut two because you want it to follow cut one, cut three.
Ideally, yeah. You, like any show, you know, songs go well with each.
Exactly.
It's pacing.
Yeah.
But, you know, like we were talking, I don't know if we were on air or but the podcast thing, do people listen to whole albums anymore? And we all know that they don't.
Yeah.
You know, you just try to get them with whatever you can. So ultimately, you just satisfy your urge as an artist to write a book, basically. And so certain things, well, you can't have that song there because it makes no sense with
that. Interesting.
So yeah, it's just telling a story, for me at least. So the reason Willow Springs did so well, I think was, it's back to the authenticity. I think it was the first album I wrote really sober. So that was what was different. Yeah. I didn't think it was any different than any other record I put out, but people certainly reacted to it. So there must be something there.
Do you and your Heather ever write together?
We have, yeah.
What's that like?
Well, it's great. You know, we have very different styles. So, but we do, and when we do, it's organic. You know, we don't try to sit down and do something together. I'll be like, hey, this would be, you know. So we've done it before, and it's been great. So, you know.
You still have any friends from the old bad days?
Somewhat. Not many, because, you know, you got to cut those people loose, you know, obviously.
Well, some get sober, though. I mean, some follow that.
Well, you know, now I've become this, like, ambassador for sobriety. I get calls from people I barely know, or people on Facebook write me, and I'm just like, I'm that guy now?
Oh, no, really? I have to. Wait, I haven't got time to help you.
I remember John Hyatt he got sober. And I love John Hyatt. He's a very nice man. But he had written something. He's like, the only bars I see now have carrots and tomatoes, and I thought, oh, please. You know, I never want to be that guy. You know,
the future for you, it is, it's a tough thing. I mean, you see yourself playing forever.
I mean, it's a concern.
And you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think if I stay healthy, you know, I certainly, you know, because listen, when I walk into the kitchen, nobody applauds. Yeah, so, like, as long as I walk in, whether I don't care how small that room is, when I walk on stage, when they applaud, that's a drug. It really is. And I think, really, ultimately, you know, Donald Trump doesn't need the money. He's got already power. He's a junkie, and his behavior, I've seen this. He's an addict. Really, it's that addict behavior, and I see it mentally. I see his erratic behavior, and it's all fueled. It fuels that dopamine hit he gets when he walks into a room and they play the thing or they chant Lock Up. He gets high off that, and he's really just a junkie, and he needs help, and he should really go to rehab.
Well, he hasn't called you yet.
No.
You expect him to call you. That would be a nice call for you to get. That would be a very nice call for you to get.
You need a lot of help, pal.
City Winery's been a good,
it
good
has,
home
yeah.
for you.
It's a wonderful place. Yeah.
What's your perfect venue? You've obviously played dozens.
Yeah.
Of different settings. What's perfect for you?
Well, I love the rock clubs are great, but you know, but everybody has to stand for a really long time, you know. And
right.
And I don't know how conducive that is anymore. So City Winery is really just a great venue. People can sit, and then, you know, it's a bit of a struggle to get them to stand up, but when they do, then it's on. But yeah, I miss the rock and roll show. You know, I've become kind of relegated to being a folk singer, really, of sorts, you know.
Yeah.
But that's kind of how I started. And
there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, it's an isolated life, though.
I think now I was thinking of seeing these stories about the Uptown.
I saw that.
You're coming back. I'm thinking, who is going to play
Yeah.
4,500 seat venue.
Because then the Aragon's right there, and
I don't think it's anywhere near.
Oh, is it not?
No.
But
yeah, to my mind, I mean, that's going to be a rough.
It will.
The last show I saw there was Springsteen. He played for 3 hours.
In 78 or something,
right? Yeah, a nice place to see Springsteen, but I don't know who's going to ever fill that place. Maybe you will.
Maybe.
And your wife, and maybe Rain will pick up a tambourine or
something.
I've
had to make paradigm shifts with mine. I'm happy with City Winery.
When you write, is it arduous for you, or do you get an idea and build on that idea. I don't mean to probe your creative.
No. It's arduous most of the time, you know. And today was a good day. Yeah, but the last
you try to write every day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I get up early and just go right at it.
Is that right?
Yeah. Today was a good day. But the last three were just, you know, like wrestling an alligator, you know. Just like, you know. And then out of that, though, really, you just write and write and write. And then if you get one good line, then you go, there it is. Wow. And then you go from there.
But you do it every morning.
Yeah, try to, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. With an instrument?
No, just computer.
Interesting. Yeah. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Michael, you're a fascinating guy.
Oh, geez, Rick.
No, you really are. You're a fascinating
guy. Wait till we get to lunch, then I'm going to turn the tables on.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. Michael wants to end with a song. I got to read a commercial. And then we'll end with a song. And your daughter's not listening. She's not.
No, she's asleep.
Good.
Yeah.
This is too late. Too dangerous. Daddy, you did drugs?
Yeah.
The curse of the billy goat is finally over, and we've got Northside champions. But the billy goat lives on in the friendly taverns at Dot Chicago and in a new place, too. At participating Jewel Osco stores, Mariano's, and Pete's Fresh Market in the Chicagoland area, you'll find the world-famous billy goat burgers frozen and ready to go home with you. You're the chef now, so start up the grill. But don't forget to add cheese, pickles, and onions to create your own world champion cheeseburger. Are your parents still alive?
No, they're not.
Neither of them?
No.
Did they see you sober?
My dad did.
And what was his reaction? Pleased, I would think.
Well, yeah.
Or suspicious.
It was hard to say. He wasn't in good shape, so they didn't really get to see it much.
You know,
which is sad, because that's all my mom ever really wanted.
Yeah, yeah. That's a shame. Let's hear this song that you wanted to play.
And appropriately
you're the disc
titled,
jockey again.
Aptly titled.
Oh, we got to take a break now? Oh, that's good. For what? Commercials? We have commercials here? I read them.
Make money.
Take a break for commercials, then we can end the show the way Michael really wants to end it, with the final song. Okay, we'll be right back. We're now just talking about how Michael McDermott is going to be introduced one day to Bruce Elliott, and that meeting.
It could be the apocalypse.
Nothing else.
Right,
it'll
there.
Inspire Bruce to write something on his blog, and it might inspire Michael to write a song about Bruce. There is absolutely no telling. Michael, it is your show. Michael, you can go. When you go to michael-mcdermott.com, you can figure out how to see his shows. Those of you around the country, you can read a very, very straightforward and frank biography that he has, an autobiography, I would call it. You can see some videos, some lyrics, you can buy stuff, and you can a little sort of even get to know Heather a little bit on that thing.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful, lovely website. He is a working musician in a crazy, crazy music business. Now you are a disc jockey.
Yeah, I am. Thank you, Rick. It was my honor.
We're pals
honestly.
Now. No.
Yeah. So Heather thinks this song is so depressing, but I don't. I think the world and I think the people were all beautifully broken, perfectly imperfect, and I think as soon as we accept that, then everything changes from there. So anyway, this is a song called This World Will Break Your Heart. Thank you.
There's an old man at the counter, and he couldn't feed himself. No one seemed to make a move to offer any help. The waitress didn't notice, she went about her day. Passed out at the bus stop, a bearded man did lay. No one got too close to check if he was okay. He had a tattoo of Semper Fi, and God bless the USA. And this world will break your heart. This world will break your heart. And this world will break your heart in a thousand different ways. A baby in the final month. The room was painted blue. They had a name picked for their son. The husband said they'd try again. He didn't know what else to say. And 50 years of marriage if he'd made it till July. The nurse gave back his clothes as she began to cry. She told the social worker she had nowhere else to stay. This world will break your heart. This world will break your heart. This world will break your heart in a thousand different ways. There's fire on the hillside and oil in the sea. The people hurting everywhere as far as I can. Just castles made of sand, and someday we're gonna wash away. And Romeo, he stumbled in with an unlit cigarette. He said he just got off the phone with Mr. Capulet, who warned, boy, best be careful, or there will be hell to pay. Babe, we're getting older. Yeah, this much is true. But each day is a gift that I get to spend with you. Babe, I'll always love you beyond my dying day. This world will break your heart. This world will break your heart. This world will break your heart.
Michael McDermott, that's a beautiful song.
Thank you, Rick.
And great success with this new
thank
CD.
You.
What's the title of it?
Out From Under.
Out From Under, which is sort of the story of your life.
Yeah,
I mean, that is. If you've been listening, you've heard the story, and it's an empowering story.
You.
No wonder people are calling you to ask for help and advice.
Mm.
You will be on again when we get this music studio up. Hey, Ben. This would be like our first guest. We'll play for 2 hours, and I'll sit here with his kid. And say, what does your dad do? What does your dad do? Say hello to your daughter, Rain, and to your wife,
thank you.
Heather, who is a talented musician in her
she
own
is.
Right. Her CD is Don't Mess With Mrs. Murphy.
And you shouldn't.
Heather Lynn Horton is her name. Thanks for listening. Aubrey Mumpower, you did a yeoman's work today, the world's greatest engineer. Ben Anderson, the world's greatest producer. Carla Mari's coming up, the world's greatest show host.